Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
Welcome to Inside the Hive. I am your host, Nick Bilton. I am convinced at this point that I could try out for the announcer job at the WWF where they welcome the wrestlers out, but I'm not going to do it. Welcome. Just kidding. All right. So I used to live in Silicon Valley, thereabouts, a few miles north of there. And I remember when I was covering these companies, people used to say to me, is this person or that person, this CEO or that employee, a sociopath? This was the word that was used all the time. Is Elizabeth Holmes a sociopath? Is Mark Zuckerberg a sociopath? Is Jack Dorsey a sociopath? And you know, when you look at them in these individual moments, you think like, well, maybe, maybe not. But when you kind of look at the industry as a whole, it seems like something isn't right up there. Like there's something in the water, or maybe we just need to kind of rethink what this term sociopath means. My guest today, Mike Isaac, who is a reporter for the New York Times, has written a book on someone who a lot of people ask, is he a sociopath? Yes, that's right. Travis Kalanick, who founded and started Uber. And he is here to tell me all of the crazy shit that happened at that company while it was growing from nothing to being worth tens of billions of dollars, including a crazy moment when the company found out about all these murders taking place with Uber drivers and kind of looked the other way. We're going to get to all of it. We're going to talk a little bit about Twitter and how I still think it's the worst experience on planet Earth and how Mike disagrees. He has a viewpoint on that. And we're going to talk about what is going to happen to tech in the coming 2020 election, whether or not a Democrat wins. So listen in. It's a great conversation and you're going to love every second of it. Mike Isaac, I can't actually believe you're here right now in the flesh. This is so exciting. I feel like this has been like, what, a year and a half in the making?
Oh my God, almost 2.
Having you on the show, almost 2 years. So, I have so many questions. We're going to talk about your new book. We're going to talk about Uber. We're going to talk about founder worship. We're going to just get everywhere. But I want to find out, did you... I remember when I wrote the Twitter book, I thought Jack Dorsey was going to kind of send some goons to my house to have me offed. Have you shown up at your apartment yet and like seen like, you know, a car waiting outside with a guy in sunglasses and a fake mustache whose real name is Travis Kalanick, waiting to like beat you with a metal pipe? Has that happened yet?
I have not received any horses' heads delivered by Uber to my apartment quite yet.
The part that I think is crazy is you wrote this book and you're still using Uber and Uber Eats. I mean, I would not be doing it. I would be terrified that someone was going to spit in my food or something worse than that.
You know, back in 2017 when I was reporting on this, the crazy year that they had and the building was just sort of on fire and all this stuff, a lot of my sources actually did, you know, they said like, look, don't. Like, take this app off your phone, delete the contact list from our servers, like, that they, you know, my people were probably, if not as paranoid as I was, more paranoid than me, just because it's a, you know, it's a surveillance-based app. They know where you are at all times, you know, when you're using it and when you're not, for a time at least, they knew when you weren't for a little bit. So yeah, there was a period where I definitely was off Uber, but maybe I'm slacking in my old age.
So let's jump in to the story. So, yeah. You know, as a tech journalist covering Silicon Valley, you know, it seems like you have the pick of the litter of like which tech company, they're all going to do something terrible and just and just vile and awful, and the CEOs are all going to be jerks and whatnot. Not all, but mostly. Mm. What made you decide like, all right, this is the one that I'm going to make into a book?
Yeah, totally. It's, you know, you and I have known each other for years now, and I've always sort of thought about doing a book, but never found the right thing or moment or whatever. But I think like Uber is sort of like apocalypse in 2017 just felt like it was about Uber, but it was kind of bigger than Uber. It was this point for tech where folks, I think, were starting to expect maybe a bit more out of the services that they use, out of, you know, the behavior of the companies that they sort of patronize. And I think that this company really encompassed all the sort of caricature of late stage capitalism that you can imagine goes on out here, whether it's like, you know, being worth billions of dollars and spending on, you know, insane headquarters, you know, black concrete and glass slabs, or throwing $25 million parties with Beyonce singing to your staff or whatever. You know, it just like really represented excess, and that's not even exaggerated.
That's just the tip of the iceberg.
And I think it was just like this excess, this moment of excess, and really crystallized in this company and this worship of this one founder, Travis Kalanick, who created a world-changing product, but ended up, you know, sort of biting off a bit more than he can chew in the meantime.
So in your reporting, the thing that I've found so fascinating about Travis is that, like, you've covered all these guys, and you can say whatever the hell you want about them, and they're probably going to be upset, but they would never let you know. Mm-hmm. Travis was the complete opposite. He was like the complete anomaly of that. I remember one time I made a mistake in a story. I thought that I had met him at Burning Man in like 2009, and it turns out it was like I had met him in 2010, whatever the hell it was. I don't even remember what it was. Like, it was the year was off or something. And he went to Twitter, literally, like, this is like, you know, and he tweeted about it. And I'm thinking to myself, like, you're the CEO of at the time the company was worth $60, $70 billion. And this is what you're doing with your time. So the question I have for you is, is he an anomaly in the respect of, like, he always took it too far, or was he just thin-skinned? Like, what is it about him that feels different from the rest of them?
I think, that's a totally, you would imagine that someone that was a multi-billionaire could let, like, little spats like that go. But maybe, you know, some folks I've spoken to have wondered maybe his inability to let these fights go or let things sort of, like, get beyond him. Maybe that was a strength in some areas of his life, right? Like you can remember back in 2014, 15, when they were just, it was just mainly them versus Lyft in the United States. And he was just murdering Lyft up and down. And his idea of winning wasn't just, okay, we're going to, you know, best our competitor. It was, you know, we're going to rub their nose in it, or we're going to make sure they know that we're winning, and nothing but complete and utter domination is what we're going to accept. And I think that is just, you know, everyone in the Valley is competitive. You've been writing about tech forever, and like, everyone out here wants to play to win, but there's winning, and then there's Travis Kalanick's version of winning, which is just, can be very obnoxious. And maybe that served him and the company for the first 5-7 years of its existence. But I think there got to a point where, as a leader, you have to maybe realize that you're big, you've won, or you've at least come out on top. And perhaps you don't have to sort of go to the mattresses for every fight, or you don't have to sort of rub someone's nose in it, or whatever, you know? And I don't know if he's capable of understanding that. I think other leaders that might be more mature or able to grow with their companies have been able to do that. And I'm just not, I haven't seen that in him so far, or at least when he was at Uber.
So you did the good author thing, and you went back all the way through his childhood, and what was some of the things that you found that were so kind of just shocking to you as you were researching, you know, the young Travis Kalanick growing up to be the guy who helped start and disrupt the taxi industry and start Uber?
Yeah, totally. I think the thing that, there were two, like, really formative things that I think helped me understand why he became, you know, who he was later on. One of those was just, you know, is kind of archetypical of a lot of tech CEOs, where he wasn't that cool when he was young. You know, he got kind of bullied as a kid, and very smart, very competitive, very sharp, but like just wanted to be cool for some period of time, you know, just like any of us. I mean, hell, I wanted to be cool, and finally I am cool.
One day, Mike, one day.
Maybe I'll be cool. Keep trying. Just tell me when I'm cool. But I think that's a really human thing to like want to be that. And that's really where later on, when you get these, you know, we would see these tweets of his like balling and like going to the club or making it rain or all this sort of like very caricaturish Wolf of Wall Street-esque version of what it means to be cool as a founder or a CEO. I think that was what he envisioned. But I don't think that, you know, unlike some of us who are, you know, I'm not as fortunate to be as naturally cool as Nick Bilton, but I will say like some folks have to try a bit harder. And I think that really, it gave me some level of weird sympathy for him. And that's what really informed some of the decisions he made later on. And then I think the other thing just outside of that is he was betrayed multiple times early on in his career. He's a serial entrepreneur, had done two startups before Uber. And one of his early backers, Mike Ovitz, the super agent from the days of yore in L.A., was someone who supported his file sharing startup from the beginning, this app called Scour, and ended up turning on him and actually letting Travis and his company get sued into oblivion while Ovitz ended up making out okay and saving face. And I think it really informed Travis's worldview later on, where you can't trust your friends, you can't trust your VCs. There's no one has your back, and you need to protect yourself at all costs. And that was a lesson he carried well into his Uber days.
So do you think that he trusted anyone at Uber, or I mean, or was it from, you know, always someone is out to get me?
No, I think he had, this is the thing, like he didn't have like a really large circle of friends there. Emil Michael was one executive, the chief business officer, who he was like half friend, half consigliere, I guess I would say. And he was, ironically, he was the guy brought in to sort of keep Travis under wraps or calm by one of Travis's board members and partners, Bill Gurley. And ended up being more of an enabler, as it turns out, or it just wasn't able to keep things in check. But I think they were, his circle of people that he trusted was pretty small. You know, he had a girlfriend, Gabby, he met through a friend, another VC, and they were very close, but then that ended and that didn't go well at all. And then his parents, you know, he trusted them. And but then, that, you know, as I talk about in the book, that sort of, there's a tragedy with his mother, like suddenly dying. So the circle gets smaller over time, and he definitely, he had bros, but I wouldn't say he had trusted confidants, that many at least.
So one of the things that I find so fascinating about the book is that, you know, when you think about Jack Dorsey, you know, he was kind of like this young feminist, for like legitimate feminist kind of hippie guy. Mm-hmm. Like Mark Zuckerberg was kind of like, you know, studying like Roman emperors and trying to figure out how he could be the next one. Mm. What's so different about Travis that you detail in the book so perfectly well, and the title, you know, really wraps up perfectly, is that he was like a bro. Like he was like a legit, you know, a legit bro. And there's the part in the beginning of the book where you talk about, he kind of copies this, and I'll let you tell the story, but he kind of copies this Amazon culture, and he does it with the bro thing. And a lot of the people in the audience at this event can't tell if it's a joke or if it's real. It's like almost like an SNL skit where you're like, is this a for real? Describe that kind of culture, because I have a hard time kind of understanding how how that became so pervasive as an identity of the company, and how it affected the decisions he made and the people he hired and so on.
No, totally. I think It's, I think there's just like a real lack of self-awareness from the very beginning from a lot of these guys that, you know, fortunately some of the employees at Uber had, but to what you're talking about, I zoom in on one of the early scenes in the book. In 2015, you know, Uber had just reached this internal milestone of hitting this number of trips. And so Travis's thing is, I'm going to take the company on a big vacation to Las Vegas, right? And Vegas, of course, is the seminal baller town where you can ride around in black cars and go see Beyonce come on stage and perform, which is what he did for the employees. But it becomes this week-long sort of bacchanal where, you know, I write in the book, a lot of just sort of unsavory things happen. But I think the real key moment for me is he does want to play up to the mythology of what it means to be a founder. You know, he writes these in this presentation to staff in I think it was in Planet Hollywood in their on stage. He shows off these list of 14 values to his employees, and you know, it's in the vein of what Jeff Bezos had done with Amazon, with the 14 principles that sort of stand up why Amazon is what it is and why, you know, customer obsession and, you know, this company is so great. And Travis essentially wants to emulate that. He always wanted to be the next sort of Bezos, but with, I guess, more Axe body spray on or something. And so he, sorry, that was a cheap shot.
That's what people are listening for.
But I think that like that was so that what his version of doing that was essentially running through. He had 14 values that he brought about for Uber, but it really was just this sort of unself-aware kind of bro-y version of that. So you know, the title of the book, Super Pumped, was one of the values that he stressed to employees. You know, we always want to approach life and our work and our career with an attitude of super pumpedness, which I'm not quite sure if that's an adjective or a noun or a verb, but it is a characteristic that he wanted all of his employees to embody. And always be hustling was another tenet of Uber and its 14 values. So like, you know, I would say fortunately there were enough people there in the audience where they were like, is this guy for real or is this what we're doing? But it really sort of, it set the tone, I think, for what kind of company Uber was going to be. And it was kind of hard to take them seriously, I guess, is what I would say. And that also, I think it also sort of made the difference between the employees who were there to embody this kind of bro culture and then the ones who were like, look, I just want to get in, get paid, and then get the hell out of here.
And the people that did say, I wanted to get in and get paid and get out of here, made an astounding amount of money, right? I mean, let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, I think that there's a kind of misconception in the Valley that you know, you're at one of these companies and you're going to be a billionaire, but there's only a few billionaires, but there's a whole lot of multimillionaires.
Yep.
What was kind of like, so for Travis, he ends up with what at the end?
I think he's like five billion. I think he's a billionaire, like, yeah, five times over, something like that.
What do you even do with that?
Well, I think he bought a house. I think he bought at least one house in Los Angeles, and he has.
I think I heard he bought two houses. I heard he couldn't decide between. I heard this from someone who spoke to him, who said he was like, I couldn't decide if I wanted to get a house on the east side or west side, and then I realized I'll just get them both.
Oh my God, I love that. I love that. Billionaire problems.
Yes.
No, I think that's, but I think your point is right. Look, I mean, it's funny. We're in this time now where Uber is sort of, if you look at the stock price, it's just getting absolutely hammered. And there are questions around if the business model is what it can be, like if it's an actual business model that can be sustainable. But early on, you know, anyone who had the foresight enough or frankly, the luck enough to invest in Uber in the first few years of its existence, or go work for Uber in the first few years of its existence, is made out with more money than God at this point, right? The early backers, you could argue Benchmark Capital, the one of the firms invested in Uber, made one of the greatest venture investments of all time, multiplied, I don't know, dozens of times over, if not hundreds. Right now, this last earnings quarter, they had they just took more than five billion in losses, particularly because of the amount of stock comp they're paying out to employees who had been there for the past you know few years before they went public as a company. So I live in San Francisco, and what I'm curious to look at is like what this city is going to look like post Uber IPO, post Lyft IPO, post this next wave of WeWork, Peloton, whatever IPOs that's coming, and what this is going to do to the fabric of this city at this point. But there's a lot of people that made, if not billions from the early on, then millions from their time at the company.
You're listening to Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
So when you look at the company now, there's been a lot, as you just mentioned, there's been a lot of people saying like, oh, well, this isn't a viable business because, you know, the thing that I find so fascinating about the whole concept is, you know, what, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but what Uber did differently was it wasn't that it allowed people to be drivers or for you to get a ride from your neighbor. It was the fact that it connected you with that person because, you know, the taxi industry was you weren't paying for the taxi per se because you could have kind of knocked on your neighbor's door and said, hey, can I pay you $50 to give me a ride to the airport? Mm. You were paying for someone to dispatch you. And what they did was they kind of created this, they got rid of that middleman, and Uber was the middleman. And the next level of that, when you have a driverless car, is why do you need Uber? Because every driverless car could have software. Like, why would Tesla, for example, if they have fully autonomous vehicles, allow Uber to be the middleman between that? So is that part of the reason that there's so much distress about what the future of this company is, or is it that they are not necessarily worth what they have, you know, what they went public at?
No, I think your points are good. I feel like it's honestly a little bit of both of those things. I think the grand irony of Uber now is that you have to credit them with unlocking the idea of the gig economy. They weren't the one to invent ride sharing, but they're the ones to popularize it, you know? And the idea that you can sort of get on demand whatever from your phone, I think really was sort of made popular by Uber. And so that's whether you think that's a good thing or not, it is here to stay, right? So that said, like it would be pretty, I guess, funny, sad, take your pick, if Uber can popularize a category without actually making money from it or making a business from it. And that's still a TBD. You know, one of the things I do think that was a mistake in retrospect is, you know, Travis had raised so much. I mean, I've never seen any private technology company raise the amount of money they had in the 10 years that they were private. They raised more than $10 billion, in some cases, like billions of dollars per round. And it just seemed like it was game over because
of that. But that money was because he believed we only have minutes to be the biggest company before someone else comes in and usurps us, right?
Yeah, I think there was
the strategy right, or was the strategy wrong?
Well, I think the strategy was predicated on the idea that if we get the biggest war chest, we're going to just sort of take the whole category, and we won't have anyone, no competitors can sort of challenge us because we've outraised them all. But I think that the problem with that is that, you know, the funding environment has changed. You have the SoftBanks of the world that can come in and just flood the zone with like $100 billion vision funds and dole out money to Didi, to Ola, to food delivery app folks, like DoorDash or whatever. So even though SoftBank's a whole other like podcast worth of material, but even though SoftBank is a backer of Uber, they are also backing some of Uber's enemies. So you end up like having Uber like money fighting against itself. But so there's that plus the idea that Uber, you know, Lyft is in a slightly better position only because they have to fight battles in the US, whereas Uber has to spend money to fight battles on, you know, multiple continents and hundreds of cities across the world. So, you know, I think maybe Travis's idea was probably sound 5 to 7 years ago, but it just seems like a really different time now. And plus, the idea that they also raised their valuation so enormously high before coming into the public markets that it was hard to sort of continue thinking it could go up from there. It only kind of went down from when they went public.
All right. So here's a question that I think is going to be a little difficult for you to answer, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Is Travis a good guy or a bad guy?
Mm. You know this? Yeah.
I'll preface this with, yeah. You know, I'll be the asshole. I personally think most of these guys are douchebags. I don't think they started out as douchebags, but you know, sure. There's the classic line of, you know, if you want to see what a man is really like, you know, give him power.
Mm.
It's of course a little bit more eloquent than I just said it, but
no, I get it.
I think that they become so the money. I remember when I was doing the Twitter book, and I remember I said to Biz Stone, who was the co-founder, and I said, you know, what does money do to you? Does it change you? And he said, no, I don't really believe that money changes anyone. I think it just puts a magnifying glass on the aspects of you that are already there. So if you're a really good person, you'll be a better person. You'll give more money away. You'll try to help more people. If you're an egotist, you'll be more egotistical. Mm. If you, you know, whatever it is, if you want power, you'll want more power. And I look at Travis, and I genuinely I can't tell. He doesn't seem like the greatest person. Like, he seems like he's got some real issues going on there.
Yep.
But I'm curious, as someone who lived in his, who he moved into your head for a couple of years as you were writing this book, like, what do you think?
Yeah, you know, it's really hard because I talk to so many people. Actually, it's funny. Everyone that I talk to around him, and everyone who's been there either from the beginning or later on, or have spent significant amount of time with him, all feel really conflicted. One day they might say the guy is a sociopath or has like serious problems. And the other day, the next day they'll be like, you know, I love him, I can't get rid of him or whatever. So I think everyone who has a relationship with him on at least some level that's, you know, have worked alongside of him for some period of time can care for him while also feeling burned or like they can't trust him. And that just seemed to be a theme in the reporting that came up over and over. I sort of have a grudging respect for him, if that makes sense, just because he became like I've just never seen anyone as resilient in these constant battles. And even, you know, I definitely would take issue with behavior and some of the ways we've crossed each other in the past. And, but it was never, but I guess like at the end of the day, like I would try to give him what he's due in terms of like, you know, he built this insane thing against very large odds. And like, so like on a base level, I can at least appreciate that. But like, look, is he like walking grandmas to church or like, have I seen him donate his millions to like the giveaway pledge or whatever? I haven't seen that yet. So it's hard for me to say like he's a good or a bad guy, but just, I do have a grudging amount of respect for him is what I would say.
So, okay. So let's talk about a couple of scenes in the book. Sure. And they definitely are scenes, and very cinematic. What were some of the most shocking moments to you in the reporting that you discovered? Kind of talk us through some of those.
Yeah, sure. So I think one of the things that I was really surprised at is the amount of like violence, involved in this company. And, the way it differs from, say, like a Facebook or a Snapchat or whatever, is that like Uber has to sort of parachute into countries and set up shop overnight. And that can mean just like barreling into cultural or economic situations that you don't have any clue about, right? So, and we talk about in this one moment in time, the security chief has to deal with Uber moving into Brazil. And one of the things that the company, and I think all startups, or many startups, but especially Uber, was talking about is just it had to grow, or, you know, if you're not growing, you're dying. Your company has to grow. And so they were growing as fast as they could in Brazil when they parachuted in there. But meanwhile, like this, the country's in the middle of economic turmoil, humongous recession, unemployment was skyrocketing, and they're having these drivers, Uber drivers, carry all cash to service customers as drivers. So all of a sudden, they start getting this rash of riders who are using fake identities to sign up and essentially rob and start killing Uber drivers in Brazil. And that you have a string of more than a dozen murders over months in Brazil because of the lack of safeguards and identity checks in the rider sign-up version of the app. And they recognized this and took a significant amount of time to change until they fixed that. And it was really disturbed me that was allowed to happen, I guess.
Isn't the part that is so astounding about that, isn't it that they that the murders were they were strangling the drivers and that they could see, Uber could see in the data, like the car jerking back and forth, like these people are actually, like, they know what's going on and they do nothing to stop it. Like, how, I mean, we go back to this, like, is he a good guy or is he a bad guy? Like, if that were me, I'd be like, let's shut the whole fucking thing down right now. Like, this is really, you know, like, we ran over one kitten. We've got to stop this whole thing.
Right.
And yet, like, people are literally being murdered and the response is kind of, you know, slow and lackadaisical. Like, What does that say about? Doesn't that say maybe not the
right guy? No, I think, well, like to your point, I think there's like the, what is it? There's like, maybe it's a sociologist, this like the trolley problem, right? Like there's this sort of greater good idea that they're doing something in service of the greater good. So once we, when Elon Musk had the problem with, self-driving sort of malfunctioning, right? Like the statement wasn't immediately like, we're sorry, this is horrible, we're doing everything we can. It was essentially like, this is going to happen, but we're on the way to progress, right? And I think that mentality is very prevalent out here, right? I think, and if you're looking at it through a very cold, hard, rational lens, you can understand well where they say like, well, once we get to ubiquity in these countries, then it will be worth it or whatever. But I think, to your point, most compassionate people might be at least somewhat disturbed on when they faced with some of these dilemmas. So yeah,
it's disturbing. Mike, this is why you and I are not billionaires.
That's right. That's right.
You are listening to Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-host cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
There was, you know, we've all heard these crazy stories of boardroom coups and so on and so forth. Mm. But Uber may take the cake. It's up in the top three. tell the story of how this all kind of goes down. And you were covering this for the Times at the time. Mm. You know, you know this inside out and backwards. Can you set the stage and kind of tell us this crazy moment?
Yeah. So I think the real crux of it comes down to, you know, Uber's 2017, they suffer sort of blow after blow, whether, you know, Susan Fowler, an ex-employee sending an internal memo like blowing the whistle on internal harassment, or you know, there was multiple DOJ investigations based on a number of incidents that were uncovered by reporting by members of the press, or was it a lawsuit from Waymo against Uber for, you know, them accusing them of theft of trade secrets and their property, intellectual property? It was just one thing after another. So by the summer of 2017, a cabal of investors, early backers on Uber, had said, you know, this is enough. Travis is now a liability and we need to remove him. So Travis is essentially blindsided at a hotel in Chicago, and I get into pretty granular detail about this in the book, but it's this real, I think the crux of the book is kind of probably the tragedy of Travis is that, like, he's kind of proven right, you know, like his all of his suspicions of venture capitalists betraying him end up coming true, and call it a self-fulfilling prophecy or just sort of like a crazy turn of events or whatever, but he's ultimately felled by folks that were his backers and close to him, and folks that he didn't think he could ever trust in the first place. It's very dramatic, and it was the most insane thing I've ever reported on.
Do you think that, you know, there's always these questions, and this happened, Twitter, Jack Dorsey came back three times, even though he was ousted in a very dramatic way and then came back to oust his co-founder.
Yeah, that was great.
Another great dramatic board moment. But he pulled it off. Like, he legitimately he didn't give up. And I would say Jack Dorsey is not as aggressive as, not even remotely as aggressive as Travis Kalanick. Mm-hmm. I don't think I've actually ever covered a CEO who's as aggressive as Travis. But that said, do you think that Travis is going to, you know, plan a coup to come back and overthrow Dara and take over the company again? And, you know,
that would be, it would make for a really good story. I think right now, I think he's smart enough to keep his head down. And right now he's working on a startup that's has to do with food delivery and dark kitchens, cloud kitchens is what it's called. But it's still like sort of symbiotically attached to Uber. And I think that worries folks that are still at the company inside of Uber, like, okay, well, our ousted former boss is still kind of in the space. And this funny thing that's happening right now, you know, Dara Khosrowshahi, the current CEO, is under a lot of pressure. The stock is in the toilet. Employees are kind of, some employees are, I would say, to be fair to Dara, like, a lot of employees are happy the building isn't on fire and things have calmed down. But there's also a meme now that's very interesting where there's a longing for the fire that Uber had from its earlier days, right? And this sort of aggressiveness and energy. And it's crazy to me to think that people would want or maybe long for a return of the king, return of Travis to come back to his company as a wayward founder. But that meme exists out there. And so I don't know if it's possible just in terms of how the stock and structure is set up and everything. But, you know, I wouldn't rule it out.
Well, once you get, you know, those same people that ousted Travis, if their net worth starts to drop by a comma, they will be probably more than happy to help, you know, pull off a Trojan horse. I mean, the thing that was so fascinating with Dorsey was, you know, when he got kicked out, he went off, he started Square, and his first attempt to try to come back was to have Twitter buy Square, and then him come in as CEO. It didn't work out that way, so he figured out another way to do it, but you could totally imagine Travis pulling something like this off. Oh, have you?
You gotta write a sequel,
Travis.
You gotta write a Twitter book sequel.
I want. I am so done writing about writing long books about rich white men who have issues because they were like picked on and given a wedgie in high school. Like, I'm done with that part of my life. Have you heard from Travis or heard through anyone from him? You know, has he read the book?
I do not. I hope he reads the book. We have not spoken. I know that he was not looking forward to this. Didn't want it to happen. And look, I don't think he ever really wanted me to to do a book on this. And maybe he probably didn't think it was going to happen at some point just because I went away for a year and a half to do it. And maybe I forgot about it or I just flaked out. But I don't know. I hope he reads it. I do think that just through other people who have talked to him that I've talked to, 2017 was like the hardest period of the guy's life. And I think it's hard for him to go through this again with this book coming out and sort of the headlines, you know, my excerpts and in Vanity Fair, like it just sort of details the gnarliest points in his life. So I imagine he's just not happy reliving that. But I also imagine that he knows to keep his head down and just continue doing his current thing. And that's probably a safer way of maybe staging his own, if not come back at Uber, just come back personally and become a revered figure again. So keeping his head down is probably a smart way to go.
But to become a, you know, to make a comeback and become a public figure again and start, you know, speaking on stages and doing mm-hmm. talks and whatnot, would require him to kind of let go of some of his animosity towards a lot of people. I mean, I told you this story. I haven't told this story publicly, but I'll tell it now. I you know, met Travis 10 years ago. I may get the date wrong. Don't tweet at me. And you know, you're friends with some of these people and you cover them at the same time and sure. they know that's the deal. And I remember, you know, after he tweeted that silly tweet, I was like, whatever, and moved on. And sure. and I was at an event for a Vanity Fair event, the Oscars party this last year for work, and I'm mm-hmm. just doing my thing work-wise. And I see him, and there's a crowd of people, and I'm walking from one direction, and he's walking from another direction. It's almost like there's a tunnel, and there's only one way through, and we're like, you know, when you got to pull over to the side for the other car to pass? Like,
yep.
And I was like, hey, and I put my hand out and he looked at me and he goes, I'm not shaking your hand, homie.
No.
And he kept walking. And at first I was like, good for him. You know what? Like what a baller that he's gonna like be like, you know what? I don't like the things you wrote about me or said about me. I'm not gonna pretend to be nice to you. And at first I literally was like, that was amazing. Like pat on the back. And then I bumped into a mutual friend of ours and I just at the party and I told him what happened. And he was like, are you kidding? The guy's worth $6 billion and like you haven't written about him in 6 months and that's how he reacts to you. Imagine how he'd react to Mike Isaac.
I don't know if he would shake my hand.
The point is that, you know, I barely covered the company. I wrote about it tangentially a little bit. You know, I haven't seen the guy in a long time. I don't imagine he's listening to this podcast. If you are, hey, Travis, call me. I love you. But the fact that he felt that way towards me, like the thousands of people higher up on that chart who've legitimately wronged him, like kicked him out of his own company, you know, talked to the press about him, talked to you, your book, like all these, like these columns that have been brutal. Like he, like you, it's like the AA. I've never gone through AA, but I, this is the part where you have to kind of go and knock on everyone's door and make an apology. Like it would take him years to get through that. Like,
I don't think he would go through that,
but so I guess the question is, if there is a comeback, is it a comeback as the same person or is it a comeback as a different person? And it doesn't feel like it could be the same person if you hold that much animosity towards that many people.
This is the sort of thing that keeps some of his friends turned enemies up at night. And the question that everyone sort of asks is like, can a person change, you know, at a certain point? Are you who you are, or can you change and grow after your experiences and become someone else? And I don't know. Maybe that is the tragedy of Travis. You know, some folks sort of say that I sound like I'm sympathetic now, but like maybe that's just his hubris is that he was perfect for a very specific period of time in this company, and no longer after he reached a certain point, you know, maybe he's not capable of changing. I don't know. And that said, like some people will grow up or he went through a lot. So I'd be happy to have him prove me wrong and come back, you know, better than ever. But I think that's a question that still haunts a lot of people that know him or knew him in the early years.
I think the thing that I find so, I mean, I went through a period when I was going through an incredibly tough time at work when I was at the Times, when my mom died of cancer very suddenly. And it was like a very fundamentally changing moment for me. And I had a kid, my first child, 3 weeks later. And the whole, it really had a massive impact, all of it together at the same time, on the decisions I made about my life and what I wanted to do when I grew up and so on. And I legitimately did feel terrible for the guy when his mom passed away in the midst of all of this crazy shit that was going on.
So maybe
that did have an impact, and maybe that's why we haven't heard from him, because he did have some sort of change of heart. But he didn't shake my hand at the Oscars party, and I'm really sad about that.
You're listening to Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
Before we let you go, I want to jump into a couple of other topics, and you know, and that you cover in the tech world. So you've been writing about all of these other companies, and it seems like there's been a change of heart since from when you and I first started covering this world over a decade ago. You know, back then we were all super excited about every technology and Twitter and Facebook and Uber and you name it. And now it feels like we are not so much. You're still, do you still use, I don't use Twitter that much. Are you still using it? I remember you were probably one of the most prolific tweeters there are.
That's sad.
Do you still twat a lot? Or?
I tried to, you know what, I would like to say I tried to kick it, and I have periods of time in which I'm off it, but no, I'm still on it. I think probably now, I think there's two things. One, it actually has been helpful in reporting, so I will say that is it. But I do think that reporters like tend to over-index on that and legitimize it as their reason for being on it and then stay on it all the time. So it's been a better version of my life with when I go through periods when I don't have as much reliance on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook and whatever. So I don't think I could ever do it cold turkey. I feel like I'm just sort of will always go through a pendulum of using these services and not, you know. And
but do you think there's going to be a larger societal pushback if my former colleague and your current colleague Farhad Manji was just like you, he used it all the time and then had this moment of like, what am I doing? And stopped. And I don't actually know a living, breathing human being that still checks their Facebook on a regular basis. Do you think we're at the beginning of a societal change with all these technologies, specifically kind of social stuff? And, or is it just like us loser people, journalists that are kind of just bored?
No, I really do think, and that's actually part of why I wanted to write the book, because, I think, you know, even beyond Uber, I think we're at a point where people are more conscious of what goes into a company, of what a service does, of how not just its employees behave, but how the apps operate. And I don't think you can get away. I don't think Facebook could get away with the things it was doing 10 years ago with the level of scrutiny that's going on today, you know? And like my thesis at least is, you know, reporters have, and this is, you know, I've thought about this too, like how my coverage has shaped things over time, and should I have been critical earlier, or have I been too excited for certain things, or have we been too optimistic? But I think you're absolutely right in that we're in this sort of reckoning period, if you want to call it techlash or whatever. I think there's going to be probably government actions, whether you consider them weak or strong enough, that's one thing. But I think there's going to be at least more conscious levels of legislation around how the services work and how they operate and how much power is consolidated in some companies in the United States. And then I also think we're going to move past that into like a post, it's not like optimism and it's not full pessimism. It's just sort of how do we live with tech in our lives in a way that we can stomach, you know, in a way that isn't just completely pervasive and disgusting. And that's going to be just an ongoing dance because, you know, unless we get nuked into oblivion, which I hope doesn't happen, tech is not going to go away anytime soon, you know. So I think
do
it's
you
about
think that we're
out.
Going to you? You've covered some of the congressional hearings and so on.
Yeah.
Do you think that depending, maybe it's dependent on, and I'm curious your answer to this, maybe it's dependent on who wins in 2020, but do you think that that we are going to have some sort of regulation to stop the things that happened 10 years ago from happening today?
I do. I think it's really funny. Back when you and I were writing about Facebook and Instagram and those acquisitions, like, I don't think today, like, that the FTC would not let an Instagram acquisition go through today, right?
That's a good point.
I think it's just really different in terms of, I think the FTC 10 years ago was just very much, I guess I would say, asleep at the wheel, or just didn't really understand the consequences of what swallowing up some of these networks would mean and how much power one can corner. And I think now they're probably going to, jury's still out for me on whether they're going to sort of really clamp down and punish Facebook, if they're going to break them up or just sort of levy like huge fines or whatever. I do think it will be dependent on who wins in 2020, what sort of like broader policy ideas that the winners have, and who's appointed to the FTC, and what senators are sort of up and coming. This Josh Hawley, who's a Republican, is actually sort of the anti-Republican in that he's very anti-tech in a lot of ways, but in ways that would make you think are less Republican and less free market than they usually are. So it's a very weird time, a very weird mix of free market slash regulated, pro-regulation folks. And I think a lot depends on next year, who takes power and what's going to be, who's going to be setting the rules.
Let's talk about Twitter for 1 minute.
Sure.
You said that, you know, we would have covered these companies differently. Like, if I'd have known what Twitter would become today, the book I wrote would have been a drastically different book, probably. Not probably, definitely. Do you think that you know, you look at the way it has kind of allowed Donald Trump, and I know you're a New York Times reporter, so you're not allowed to have an opinion on these things. Mm-hmm. So just do the best you can. do you think that the company should be doing more to kind of control the hate speech, if you will, that it's so fucking different from, and I'm sorry the cursing here, it is so drastically different to what it was like when it first started, and it seems like, you know, it seems like the company embraces that. They do nothing to try to stop it whatsoever. It's like, it's almost like, you know, they see that the turmoil on there drives users to use it. And the thing that pisses me off the most about Twitter is that, you know, people internally, the rhetoric internally is, well, it's a reflection of society. It's just a technology. Bullshit. It's a reflection of society. It is a reflection of society if we all like walked around with masks on so we couldn't see people's facial expressions and could only yell at each other for like 14 seconds at a time, and that's it. And where we all ganged up on one person every 15 seconds. Like, it's just, it seems like there are technological solutions to the problem of that platform, and yet they don't seem like they want to change them.
Yeah.
How does that play out? You think you're the only person I know who likes it. Literally, I don't know anyone else.
No.
You and I don't even think Jack Dorsey likes it, honestly. I think it's just you.
No, I do think that, like, I do, to your point, I do think that they're in this weird position where, you know, they're terrified of Republicans crying censorship. I will say Republicans have found an excellent weapon in bludgeoning Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and basically any tech company that gives a sort of speech platform with this idea of censorship if they hammer them with any sort of rules around speech or taking down their tweets or their posts or whatever. And tech companies are much more sensitive, and one could argue maybe perhaps overly sensitive to what Republicans, it's sort of ironically overly sensitive to give Republicans more room than some people feel that should be allowed. So they've managed to sort of beat the tech companies into submission by doing that. I think there's going to be, I think, you know, one solution would be to, the sort of big rub is that Zuckerberg or Dorsey or anyone who owns and operates a YouTube, like a huge platform like this, doesn't want to rein in their own power. It's still about keeping the platform as big as possible, reaching as many people as possible. And like, so like any form of like self-limiting or self like restriction is almost counterintuitive to how they want to spread and operate. So it seems like they're going for two different things at the same time, like make it a safe place to be, but also don't stop growing and continue sort of like spreading everywhere. And we want everyone to use it. And I don't think there's any real tidy solution to policing things at this scale. I think as long as people figure out ways to weaponize and manipulate platforms faster than we can even foresee them, then it's just going to continue happening. It is pretty dark view, in my opinion.
It's very dark. It is very dark. All right. So last couple of questions. Yeah. Is there anything you're kind of excited about in technology? Is there like, you know, anything that you're like, woo,
it's actually good?
Or is it just like, ugh.
I will say the one thing that brings me joy, and maybe this is like me being, I don't know.
If you say Twitter, I'm going
to
hang
up on
you.
No, it is not Twitter. I swear to God. It's not Twitter. The one thing where I like go down a fun hole is, do you ever look at TikTok? Have you ever gotten any viral videos on TikTok?
I have spent some time on TikTok, and I had a discussion with a friend about this, about, oh, look, it's like such a creative place. And they were like, yeah, but it kind of monotonized the creativity. But I had a night where I spent probably 3 hours looking at the cowboy dance videos on TikTok and loved every second of it.
Isn't that great? Like, that's the thing. Yeah. Once you go down one of those TikTok holes, like, it was actually like joy. Like Sarah, my wife and I, Sarah, we both like would just sort of watch this stupid stuff, and it was actually a real fun. It felt like what the internet was early on, when you could still like have joy from it or whatever. And I'm sure there will be a day in which, like, you know, Russian spycraft starts manipulating my brain through stupid TikTok videos. But at least right now, it's very nice. So like, that's
my... Do you tick or talk, or how do you, do you tick or talk?
I think I'm too old to TikTok. I think I'm just a passive consumer at this point. Like on Twitter, I actively put stuff out into the Twitter sphere, but I think, you know, with every new generation of new wave of apps and sort of wave of creators, I think this one has passed me by, and I'm more like a consumer of TikToks, and I think I'm okay with that. Like at this point, I don't need to be a TikTok name. I'm fine with just sort of like seeing what bubbles up to the top and then enjoying that. But
I actually kind of love that you still tweet a lot. It's like I actually tweet probably like once every 3 weeks now, and every time I do it, I'm like, why God did I do that? Because I get all these responses of people that are like, you're an asshole, your dog's ugly,
oh, God.
You know, like get a new haircut or whatever. and like I imagine that like maybe like 5 years from now, it's like, it's just you and Donald Trump on Twitter. There's no one else there. And you guys are like, hey, what's up? What's up?
Oh, my God. The global town square.
The global town square, two people. All right. So last question for you. With the book, we'll go back to the book for a second here. Yep. Do you what is the like your favorite moment? You know, we all have, when we write books, we all have like a favorite moment that stands out to us. Like, what is your favorite thing that you discovered or that you got to write, like a passage or whatever it is, like the moment that you're like, that was really cool or fun or whatever it is. Like, what's the thing that you're, I guess, the most proud of in there?
Sure. I think there's probably two things, but I think in terms of, I'll just say the one thing that I think was kind of hilarious. In the middle of, Uber plans this, you know, they've had months of like culture horror show revelations, and they did this big presentation exploring, you know, this is our investigation into our culture issues, and we're going to make this company a good place for women to work, and we're doing the right thing and turning it around. And so they have this internal presentation where they're talking about how they're going to make Uber a great place for women. And then one of the board of directors members, David Bonderman, goes on stage and starts, he makes a misogynist comment about how women talk too much in the middle of this presentation. And it was just sort of like perfect, like absurdity, like moment of like, oh my God, how does Uber shoot itself in the foot even on its redemption tour, right? And in the, one of my sources told me about Bill Gurley, another board member, was on stage, and when he heard Bonderman make this remark, he just buries his head in his hands and starts shaking his head. And he's like, oh my God, we can't win even on our best day of trying to redeem ourselves, still have to just shoot ourselves in the foot. So it's kind of the story of this company. It's sort of a comedy of errors that lasted for at least a year, if not much longer.
Well, the book's amazing. It's just, it's like a thriller page turner. I loved every second of it.
Thank you.
The book is super pumped. The Battle for Uber. Go buy it now, or listen to it, or have it injected into your veins, or watch it on TikTok. Mike, thank you very much. I really, really appreciate it.
Nick, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks to my guest this week, Mike Isaac, who I do not think is a sociopath, but time will tell. If you enjoyed this conversation, be sure to listen and subscribe to other great episodes of Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton. That's me. You can find these on Apple Podcasts, radio.com, or anywhere you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a very nice review while you're there. It's not that difficult to say something nice rather than something mean. Thanks to the folks at Cadence 13 for their production work, and thanks, of course, to my sponsors this week, Lightstream, KiwiCo, and Stamps.com. Please support them the same way you support this podcast. I'll see you next week for a guest that is going to blow your mind. Have a good one.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson.
Oh.
Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. The jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
From PRX.